Change has come to America.
The truth out there.
Some alien race to come down and threaten us.
The military industrial complex.
A highly funded yet unofficial government agency.
I've now been in 57 states.
Hello and welcome to Myth Arc Radio. I am Derek Gilbert.
Hi, and I'm Sharon Gilbert, and I'm sitting here in my snappy paisley pink hazmat suit, which gets cuter every time. And Derek is, well, I'm not really sure what he's wearing.
This is my scrubs.
Oh, with little duckies all over them.
We are recording this on Thursday, April 14th.
So this is a special edition of Myth Arc Radio. We normally do this on Sunday evening, but this is a super, just slightly past the middle of the week treat.
We have been tracking several viral outbreaks around the globe, and one in particular, well, two in particular, actually. One is the Marburg virus that has been spreading across the West African nation of Angola. The other is something we've been tracking for quite some time, because Sharon's novel, The Armageddon Strain, is based on a modified version of the avian flu.
Avian flu virus, H5N1.
One of the sources of information we've been turning to in recent days is a website called Recombinomics.com. It's the homepage of a company based out of Pittsburgh named Recombinomics.
Mm-hmm.
The president and founder, Dr. Henry Nyman, is a specialist in molecular virology. He has done research with Harvard Medical School and a number of other prestigious institutions around the country. He holds a number of patents related to genetic sequencing of viruses and so forth. We contacted him today and asked if he would mind joining us tonight on Myth Arc Radio.
So you get to listen to not one, but two episodes. We're going to have them back-to-back posted on the MythArcRadio.com site, and you will get to listen to parts one and two without waiting a week in between from Dr. Henry Nyman.
Doctor, thank you for joining us tonight.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here, Derek. And hi to you, Sharon, also.
Oh, how are you doing?
It's been pretty busy. A lot going on.
That's what we understand. We hope you're going to share some of that with us tonight.
Now, Sharon's first novel, or I should say the second novel, most recent novel, which she began writing a little over a year ago, actually is based on a hypothetical situation, a fictional situation, in which the avian flu is modified to make it extremely dangerous to the point where it can be weaponized and used as a means of terrorizing a population, if not, you know, eliminating a big chunk of it at the same time.
That's true.
So we've been following the avian flu, the H5N1 spread throughout Southeast Asia, and now we understand, Doctor, there are some things that are developing with that virus now that are really worth telling.
Can I really quickly, before we get too far into it, though, Dr. Nyman, can you really quickly, just for those people who know nothing about a virus, explain very simply what a virus is and what the H and the N, why they're called H number, N number?
Okay, sure. The H and the N really have to do with the two molecules on the surface of the virus. And,
mm-hmm.
and one of the molecules, the H, stands for hemagglutinin, and it helps the virus get into the cell. And then the N is for neuraminidase, and it helps the virus get out of the cell. And the virus really only has, flu only has 8 genes, so it doesn't have a lot of genetic information.
Huh.
And it essentially relies upon the cell to replicate, so it to provide additional machinery to give it components so it can kind of recreate itself. So it comes in with its genes, and it comes in with enzymes to copy its genes, but then it requires the cell to kind of provide the environment to put everything together and get the virus back out again.
Mm-hmm.
The numbers are just they're really serological numbers. They're really used to distinguish one virus from the next. And essentially, if there's a new strain that comes up and it doesn't match any of the existing one, it gets a new number. And that actually just happened with the H. There were 15 H's, and now there's 16.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, the 16th was there were birds, gulls that didn't match any of the others, and that just happened the last couple of months or so. And then there's the N is there's nine different N's. Mm-hmm. So you can come up with 144 different combinations just with the H's and the N's.
And there are variants of each of those?
Yes, there's, because the virus actually has eight genes, so the numbers really change when it's a pretty dramatic difference, and the sera no longer cross reacts with it. So, mm-hmm. So there's standard sera that are used to type each of these, and so if a sample comes in, those sera are used to figure out if it's H1N1 or H3N2, or in case of avian, H5N1.
Now, the flu that we keep reading about in the news is the avian flu, which is a bird flu. Now, can humans get that?
Yes. Well, what typically happens right now, humans, other than the one that actually got mailed out, normally circulating right now, there's only two H's that easily infect humans. That's H1 and H3.
Mm-hmm.
H2 kind of disappeared, and that's the reason it's in the news today, is it actually got mailed out to almost 4,000 different labs around the world.
Okay, so to H2 would have been a that explains why it hasn't been used in vaccines since 1968.
Right.
Correct. It basically was replaced by H3, and that's typically what happens in the pandemics, is that a new H comes along that is able to grow or use a human receptor, but people haven't become immunized against it, and then it turns into a pandemic because it now can infect humans, but humans don't have antibodies because it's a new strain.
Right. And for those who don't know, pandemic means worldwide. Epidemic means outside of your area, doesn't it? Like more than just the United States?
Correct.
And
well,
endemic.
Epidemic is kind of localized. Pandemic would kind of be a couple countries. It would be more than a couple. I mean, pandemic, like you say, does end up covering the whole world. An epidemic, you know, you can have an epidemic within a given country, but it's quite a bit bigger than a pandemic. And then
right. Not localized to St. Louis.
Right. It's very localized. It's just an outbreak. So it kind of goes from outbreak to epidemic to pandemic.
Okay.
And as far as a virus becoming a pandemic, frequently what does happen is that it's a new H that doesn't normally infect humans, for instance. So the H2 was really replaced by H3 in 1968. That's why H2 really hasn't been around much.
Mm-hmm.
And H3 has been around. So if you get a flu shot today, you'll against the influenza A, there's basically two components of A and one of B. You would get a shot that would include the three viruses, two of which were A, one's H1N1, the other's H3N2, and then you get an influenza B virus thrown in there. And so they don't include H5, which is the avian virus, which
right.
normally does just infect birds. Now, it really kind of came to the forefront in 1997 when there was a H5N1 outbreak in Hong Kong. And in that instance, there were 18 people that were infected, and six of the 18 died. That, you know, raised a lot of concern because it was the first time H5 had actually gone directly from the bird to humans and was able to infect humans. And as a result, Hong Kong essentially culled all of their poultry. They really killed all birds that they had in the markets. I mean, Hong Kong's a fairly, you know, small geographical area, so they could actually do that.
Mm-hmm.
And that pretty much eliminated the H5N1 in 1997.
Mm-hmm.
Then it came back again right about the time of SARS. And in fact, many people thought the SARS was avian flu because there were two cases that were in Hong Kong again. They had come back from China, from Shenzhen province. I'm sorry, from Fujian province.
Mm-hmm.
And
yes.
They ended up, the son ended up surviving, the father ended up dying. There was a sister that basically died back in China, and they had H5N1. And their H5N1 was quite a bit different than the 1997 version. Then the next big outbreak really came at the end of 2003. And it was originally described as a mysterious disease that was affecting children in North Vietnam in Hanoi. So there were children that were coming in. Initially, it was called a mysterious disease. Then it was called influenza A, and then it was called H5, and in fact, it was H5N1. So H5N1, the current version, really just started right at the end of 2003, went into 2004, and it coincided with an outbreak of H5N1 that it was without precedent. It really hit most of the countries in Asia. And it mostly hit birds, but there were human cases, and the human cases, at least the reported human cases, were confined to Vietnam and Thailand. And what was striking about the cases was there were a fair number of them, but even more striking was the case fatality rate. So, and it was running about 70%. So about 70% of the people that went in the hospital and were diagnosed as having H5N1 did not come out alive. So that was a very high kill ratio.
Now, the most famous type of flu most people are familiar with is the Spanish flu of 1918. Just for comparison, what was the case fatality rate for the Spanish flu compared to the H5N1 that's floating around right now?
Well, that's why it's so frightening. The 1918 pandemic was in the 2.5 to 5% range.
Wow.
So this is over 10 times more lethal.
Wow.
Than
oh my
the
goodness.
Version in 1918. Now in 1918, that virus, you know, did travel around the world and affected, you know, almost everybody. And the estimates were between the average was probably 40 to 50 million people died. The mm-hmm. lower estimate would be like 20. Some people think it's closer to 100.
Right.
And the
mm-hmm.
population back then was about a quarter of what it is today. So if you just did it based on number of people, all those numbers would be multiplied by four. But, there's some aspects that could make it worse today, and there's, you know, some aspects that would make it better. There's antibiotics. Some of the patients did die from secondary bacterial infections.
Right.
One of the problems, though, is people don't realize that if it's a true pandemic, you know, a lot of these resources that you take for granted will have problems. I mean, you'll have doctors and nurses dying. You'll have mm-hmm. beds mm-hmm. full. You won't be able to see a doctor. You won't be able to get the medications distributed. And it won't be quite as easy as mm-hmm. it, you know, might look on paper.
Well, and depending on how many people are affected, it will affect trucking mm-hmm. and airlines getting food out.
Right, right. A true pandemic would, WHO has estimated that it'll usually last a couple of years. So over like a two-year period, they estimated that between a quarter and a third of the world's population would get infected. So that's between 1.5 and 2 billion people.
Hmm.
And then how well that would translate to the case fatality rate. I mean, if it would maintain the case fatality rate, then, you know, you're really talking, you know, a billion people, 1 out of 6 people
mm-hmm.
dying. And you can imagine that would certainly
yeah.
affect commerce and just about everything.
Mm-hmm. We're talking the rider on the pale horse, yeah.
Right. And,
yeah.
But, you know, whether it would hold on to its high case fatality rate isn't clear. And there's actually some hints, and that was one of the news items that came out today. Was that the virus in Vietnam, and it wasn't specific enough. I have a feeling they were talking about the virus in northern Vietnam versus southern. The news kind of stopped in southern Vietnam right before the Tet Lunar New Year. But before the information on human cases anyway stopped, The fatality rate was actually 100%. There were no patients in the southern Vietnam, in the Mekong Delta area, that were infected and confirmed and survived. So they had 100% case fatality rate. Whereas in the north, they did have quite a few discharges. The fatality rate was closer to 20%. And the news that came out today was that there was some data showing that the virus was changing. It was changing gradually, structurally. So the genes were slightly different than they've been.
Mm-hmm.
And that the fatality rate was going down, but the transmissibility was going up. And the transmissibility is really the rate-limiting step here. The virus is a H5N1 is an avian virus, and so it doesn't really transmit that well from human to human. The most of the examples, or at least up until a month or two ago, most of the examples were within families. And what would typically happen is one person would get sick, probably from a bird, and then whoever took care of that person in the house would typically get sick a week or two later. And it was called a bimodal distribution. So if you just looked at the dates that they showed their first symptoms, you would see the first case at one time and then a week or two later the second. And that's a strong indicator of human-to-human transmission, especially in a disease like this where it's so rare in humans. Mm-hmm. So that was showing that it was happening in families, but the clusters were small, and so the transmission wasn't very efficient. I mean, most of these clusters within families only amounted to two or three people. So usually one person would get sick and one person that took care of them, or maybe two people that took care of them, but the whole family wouldn't get sick. And it would be limited to a couple within the family. So that was showing human-to-human transmission, but it was probably required close contact.
Right.
I mean, there's a lot of virus that would be in, you know, if they have if they vomit or have diarrhea, there's a lot of virus in those types of fluids, and so cleaning those up would be a very risky activity, and it would be fairly easy for somebody to transmit that way. But it wouldn't be casual contact. So I mean, you weren't going to get sick just by taking the bus with somebody. But that started to change, particularly in the north, about a month or two ago. And it began with a family again. It was a brother and a sister. And they ended up both going in the hospital. And then the nurse that was taking care of them got sick. And that's usually a red flag, that as soon as healthcare workers start to develop the illness, that's because the efficiency of transmission has improved, because usually the healthcare workers are going to be trained more, and they're going to take precautions, they're going to use universal precautions. And so then the healthcare worker got sick, and then another healthcare worker got sick. Now, the second one ended up testing negative, but there were problems with the assays there, where they were really only detecting in the south probably about 20% of the cases. So the fact that the second healthcare worker was negative, it would be a very strange coincidence that they would develop symptoms at about the right time. This transmission chain was kind of linear. So one got sick, and then a week later the next, and a week later. So the transmission chain went for about a month, and it went to four people. And that's still, it's still not as efficient as a normal flu.
Right.
But that was the longest chain at the time. Then the second event was really in Haiphong province, where an entire family got sick and went in the hospital the same day. And it was a family of five. And the husband was like 37, the wife was 34, they had a 10 and 4 and 4-month-old daughters, and all five of them went in the hospital the same day. They all were tested positive, and they're actually all recovering, but that was the first time that you really had efficient transmission. So five out of five people all got sick at about the same time. Exactly what the source was wasn't clear. And then a day or two later, their neighbors got sick.
Oh.
And the results on the neighbors, there were like three neighbors, those results haven't come back, but it's been a long time. And I think if the neighbors were really negative, the Vietnam would be very anxious to put that information out, and that didn't come. And then there was another, in the Central Highlands, there was another commune where one person died, a 13-year-old girl died, and then her 5-year-old brother got sick. He tested positive for H5N1. And then there were literally almost 200 people in the commune with flu symptoms. And then investigators went, the health officials found out about it from a news media report, and they came, and they didn't think the people were as sick as they expected, but they took samples from 37 of them. And that data has not come back. And so, again, it was fairly high profile. A lot of people knew about these people all developing flu-like symptoms. And if most of them were negative, that probably would have made the news, and that was almost 3 weeks ago.
Wow.
So there's a chance that they had it, but most of them survived. I mean, the only case that was reported was this original 13-year-old girl. Her 5-year-old brother did end up surviving. He was in the hospital for 2 or 3 weeks, and most of the other people that had these symptoms were on the road to recovery. But that's where you're getting a trade-off, and that's what the concern is that if H5N1, it doesn't need to be killing at 70% to be a pandemic. It doesn't even have to be killing at 20% if it's efficiently transmitted. If it's, anything, normal flu is going to be like a tenth of a percent. So if it's anything in the 2 to 3 or 4% range, then that can cause a lot of problems.
Mm-hmm.
And then the third one, which I think the United States took note of this, it actually happened on April 1st. And this was a physician who was in another province just north. Each of these clusters are in adjacent provinces. They're right along the eastern border of Vietnam. And the last one was in Quang Ninh, which is right next to mainland China. And this was a 34-year-old physician who suddenly developed acute respiratory distress. And this was on a Friday, and he was dead on Sunday. And they initially said they thought he might have SARS, which was kind of like, where did SARS come from? I mean, SARS hasn't been in Vietnam since 2003.
Mm-hmm.
There were some cases in China in 2004, but they were all pretty mild. Nobody ended up dying from it other than one case that resulted from an escape from a lab, actually. And so it was kind of, where did SARS come into northern Vietnam? And usually if a physician gets it, it's because he caught it from his patient. Well, where's the patient with SARS? And so there was no patient with SARS. And it doesn't look like the physician had SARS, but the physician probably had bird flu. And the two clues that he had bird flu was, number one, that was the day that President Bush signed the executive order to bird flu.
That's right.
That could be quarantined.
Quarantined, absolutely.
Second clue was, then it was revealed that there were three other patients in the hospital that had bird flu, and the words of reassurance weren't reassuring at all. They said that, well, they were in the hospital, but they were in a different ward.
That doesn't reassure me.
No. So the fact that you had four people all developing bird flu, two were confirmed, one was suspected, and then you had the physician. So you had two that definitely had it, two more that probably had it. They all were sick within a few days of each other, and they were all within the same hospital. This was the Vietnam Sweden hospital. It was like, they've all got bird flu, and the physician didn't have any history of any exposures to poultry. And that's the other aspect of these clusters that I just described. Most of the poultry in Vietnam is in the south, so most of it's in the Mekong Delta. And, if you've been watching, it's almost Well, it slowed down because there isn't that much, but you know, there were daily announcements that this province has not had a case of bird flu for the last 21 days. So every time they hit 21 days, they would announce a new province. I think it may be down to one province that has had bird flu in the last 21 days, and it's in the south. So where the human cases were happening, or at least ones that made the newspapers and the media, were predominantly in the north. They weren't as lethal, but they seemed to be much more transmissible, either human to human or even bird to human. And that's one aspect that hasn't really come through that clear, is that the transmission itself, in other words, the chance that you're going to get infected, is actually higher human to human in these family clusters than it is bird to human, because there's literally been, the latest numbers that came out this week, that there were like 10 million birds that were culled in Vietnam.
Uh-huh.
And after this massive, that was last year, and then there weren't as many this year. They were trying to be more selective, and most of the cases were on these smaller backyard types of farms where people had 10, 20 chickens or ducks that they were raising. They, uh-huh. they weren't the big, the larger, you know, industrial type farms. And so there weren't as many that were killed, but quite a few were killed. And the news just came out this week that in the Mekong Delta, where most of the poultry is, there were 11 provinces, and they tested across all 11 provinces and found out that 71% of the ducks had H5N1.
Yeah.
And so that's a lot of ducks. And
yeah.
the worry about the ducks is that they generally don't get sick. So they are loaded with virus. They're excreting virus all the time. And
they don't show
healthy
symptoms. Yeah.
So they're basically walking around. People don't know that they're infected with the virus. And they're spreading virus all over.
Lovely.
And it was literally 71%. And I think they either tested 2,000 or 20,000. I mean, it was a big number that was tested. It wasn't that they, you know, tested 100 and got 71.
Yeah.
It was 71% across all 11 provinces. And so there's a lot of the virus in the poultry. And there's not that much, at least reported, in the humans. So it's still not that efficient going from birds to human. But now these clusters are all getting bigger, and the ones particularly in the northeast are in provinces that are right next to each other. So you start out with families, then you have families plus neighbors, then you have several people within the province, and now you've got adjacent provinces. So
mm-hmm.
you're getting a... And this is all happening pretty much in the absence of birds. So it looks like it's transmitting more human to human.
Now,
not as lethal, though.
I remember when I was studying back in Bloomington at Indiana University that we were taught that avian flu had to go through a little lab mix in a pig to be communicable to a human.
Right.
Yes.
And so the pig is a mixing vessel.
Right.
Was used pretty much to explain the 1957 and the 1968 pandemics.
Mm-hmm.
The 1997 with H5N1, that was kind of one of its distinguishing characteristics, is it looked like it went straight from bird to human and didn't involve the pig.
That's really interesting.
Now, I've looked at the sequences in Vietnam and Thailand, and they do have some changes that are unique to those two countries that aren't seen in the other H5N1s, because there was quite a lot of H5N1 in birds, especially reported last year. It's not clear whether it's down as much as it looks like it's down this year, or the reporting is some kind of diminished. But the differences that were found in both Vietnam and Thailand, if you look to find those changes in other influenza viruses, they did show up in mammalian sequences. So you could find them in human viruses, you could find them in pig viruses. And so there may be some of that mixing still going on, but it's not as obvious, because what's happening is it's more of a recombination, which involves
right.
parts of genes, whereas The others were reassortment, where they actually were swapping whole genes. So with the reassortment, both of them require a dual infection. So you have two different viruses that infect the same cell. And then when the material gets packaged up again, with the reassortment, you take a couple of the genes from one virus and a couple of genes from the other, and you come up with a new
like, a daddy and a mommy.
Well, one from
column A.
So that's what the reassortment is. The reassortment is really like, you know, sexual reproduction. The recombination, though, creates new genes. So it takes part of one gene from one, and it takes part of the other gene, the same gene from the other, and you end up having, you know, a like a combination of the two, and that can happen. So it really almost looks like point mutations if it's two viruses that are closely related.
Right.
And that's what it looks like is happening in Vietnam and Thailand. So it is not as obvious that there was a pig involved, but there may very well have been a pig, or it could have been a human. I mean, one of the characteristics of the viruses from Vietnam and Thailand is their resistance to some of the antiviral drugs, amantadine and ramantadine. And that type of resistance typically was found in humans. I mean, that was one of the drawbacks of those two antivirals, is that it would be fairly easy for the virus to mutate around those and develop resistance. And all the viruses in Vietnam and Thailand have that. And so it's not really clear. You know, it seems that they picked up those genes, and whether it was being used for chickens or whether, I mean, gamecock fighting is big there. So they had these prize birds that, you know, they would treat them with any drug they could get a hold of if they were sick, or they really did come from humans that had been treated with these drugs and had viruses that were resistant to the drugs, and they were picked up.
So we need to watch for then what's happening in Vietnam, which seems to be the flu virus is becoming more transmissible, and it's showing some resistance to antivirals at the same time.
Well, it's always had that. I mean, the human cases from Vietnam and Thailand from day one, that was one of the characteristics that distinguished them from the other. That they not only had one mutation, they actually have two mutations. So they have two mutations in the same gene, both of which each by themselves creates resistance to these two drugs. And then they are really the only isolates that have two mutations in this particular gene, and it's in virtually all of the isolates. All the H5N1s from Vietnam and Thailand have this. They've had it since 2004, when the first viruses were isolated.
So does Tamiflu work against that at all?
Tamiflu works. I mean, it's interesting. I mean, the Tamiflu is really what a lot of countries are relying upon, and that's what they're putting into their stockpiles. So Tamiflu actually attacks the virus itself, and then it attacks the N. These amantadine and ramantadine, there's another gene is called M for matrix. It's inside. And they attack that particular protein, whereas Tamiflu attacks the neuraminidase. And, you know, that was the molecule that helps the virus get out of the cell, so the virus kind of gets stuck in the cell, can't get out, and it limits the spread. That was tested against all nine N's. There's nine different N's. And it actually works best against the N2, which is the most common human virus, the H3N2. So it works quite well against H3N2. And it works among the worst against N1s. And so H1N1 or, of course, H5N1.
Mm-hmm.
It takes about 20 times as much of the drug in vitro to basically inhibit half of the lower the ability of the virus to infect by a half. And then the isolates out of Vietnam and Thailand, there's another threefold. So it's almost 60-fold weaker against those than it is against H3N2. But it is still, it is still recommended. It is used in Vietnam and Thailand. The one instance that I think gave it its best test on pandemic conditions actually happened in Thailand. There was a there was an outbreak in tigers in a zoo in Thailand, and it started with actually infected chickens that were fed to the tigers.
Ah, yes, I remember reading about
and
that.
This was like last September or so, and it ended up. It looked like it ended up being tiger to tiger transmission because a lot of the tigers didn't get chickens, and the infected chickens came from a smaller vendor, so a lot of the chickens that did go in wouldn't have been infected. And the zoo had 441 tigers at the beginning, and they when a few of them started to die, they really started to die at two or three or four a day. Then they segregated out the tigers, and then they started them on Tamiflu, and they were giving them Tamiflu, I believe. The details, I think, will be out in about a month or so, but it sounded like from the media reports that they were doing it both to treat those that were infected and also to use prophylactically to try to prevent it. Mm. Tamiflu is recommended for both of those applications. And in spite of the Tamiflu, 147 of the tigers ended up dying.
Wow.
45 died, and another 102 were euthanized because they were so sick that they didn't think there was any chance for them to recover.
And so
even if they were all exposed, you still had 33% dying. But
wow.
In all likelihood, most of the ones that survived were never infected with a virus and were never even exposed to the virus because they were segregated and quarantined fairly
mm-hmm.
early. And it could have been as high as 100% of the ones that were exposed ended up dying, and that was with Tamiflu. So in that particular instance, it's not clear that Tamiflu did a whole lot. And,
yeah.
And they were using it at double the recommended dose.
Hmm.
And it still didn't help too much. So that's probably the biggest negative for Tamiflu. The biggest positive for Tamiflu is there isn't anything else. So it's only the only approved antiviral that's available in quantity. There's another similar drug that has to be administered through a spray, and it's just not all that available. And
that's
the
right.
other,
and
the
that
other
uses a live virus, doesn't it?
I'm sorry.
Doesn't the spray use a live virus?
No, that's actually the human. That's flu mist, and in that case, it's a live attenuated virus in the human. This is
that's right. That's right.
Another antiviral.
That's right.
It's just not in high quantity. And, well, that's the other problem with Tamiflu, that a lot of countries are, saying that they're prepared and they've stockpiled all these, but most of them haven't really physically stockpiled the drugs yet. They put their orders in. And the problem is there's only one company, Roche, that makes it.
Mm-hmm.
And they only were able to make a couple million courses initially, and I think they're working on doubling their capacity, which would get up to 8 million. But if you read the media reports, you've got all of these countries
mm-hmm.
that have got 10 to 20 to 30
uh-huh.
million doses, and there's only four made. So it's not like they're not all going to get 20 million.
And, Dr. Nyman, I'm going to ask you to hold that thought for just a minute. We're going to take a really quick break, and we'll be right back to explore exactly what we here in America need to think about with regard to the avian flu. Hold on, we'll be right back.
Gonna step up to the microphone, say it loud and clear. A better day is coming soon to get us out of here.
In the grip of a psychotic mass murderer. He is responsible for the deaths of untold millions of men, women, and children. His power is exercised through a network of secret societies, and it reaches into the very highest levels of governments all over the world. examine the evidence, draw your own conclusions. Peer into darkness with Derek Gilbert and Sharon Gilbert on PID Radio, www.pidradio.com.
Step up to the microphone, say it loud and clear. A better day is coming soon to get us out of here.
Good evening. This is Sharon Gilbert, and I want to welcome you to Myth Arc Radio. This is part two of the interview with Dr. Henry Nyman, a well-known molecular virologist. And it looks like, Derek, did you change your clothes?
Yes, this is my level 4 hazmat suit. After speaking with Dr. Nyman, when we changed the tape, I went and changed in. Well, I just thought I wasn't properly dressed for the second half of this interview.
No, actually, to not be silly, because this is a very serious subject, and as we've mentioned before, we're not discussing subjects like this, diseases that are showing case fatality rates of 20%, 70%, 100%, for the purpose of scaring people.
No, we just really want to inform people. And sadly, the mainstream news isn't doing it. And I suppose when we have case number 1, 2, or 3 over here in the United States of one of these diseases, then we'll hear about it. But in the meanwhile, because it's over there, mm-hmm. we're not hearing about it. So we want to bring on board someone who not only knows about it, but knows very much what's going on and what will happen with it. That's Dr. Henry Nyman. So this is part two of our interview with Dr. Nyman.
We're back on Myth Arc Radio with Dr. Henry Nyman, president of Recombinomics, and we'll make sure to give you the link to his website here in just a little bit to make sure that you've got access to this information that we've been feasting on the last few days.
Boy, that's the truth.
As a source of really excellent analysis for what has been making it into the news. And unless I misunderstand your take on a lot of what's coming out of these situations around the world, Dr. Nyman, not everything is being reported, and perhaps maybe even spun just a little bit.
Boy, that was a delicate way of putting that.
I don't want to put words in his mouth, but
I mean there is a fair amount of spinning that does happen, and there are kind of standard catchphrases that. They show up on most of the major wire services, and they kind of get repeated, and they're a real optimistic read of the data, and even when the data changes, it doesn't. And that's happened with bird flu, and it even happened with Marburg, and some of it was so glaring. I mean, for Marburg, the fatality rate was so high mm-hmm. that if you had 110 cases and you had 100 deaths, the reporters assumed that it was 100 dead and 110 that were ill. It wasn't 100 dead and 10 that were ill.
Yeah.
And so they started reporting those numbers as the total is being in addition to the deaths. And that happened at the beginning, and then it kind of stopped, and then it started again today. So I don't know if they have new reporters mm-hmm. or what. But that's kind of an error. Back to the bird flu. The human-to-human transmission is played down a lot, and part of that is due to what some scientists are looking for, and part of it is just to kind of keep a lid on things. At the molecular level, WHO is really looking for this reassortment, so they're looking for a new virus to emerge that has mostly avian, but has picked up a human gene or two.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not clear that that's really going to happen because the virus has been evolving for the past 3 or 4 years, and it is increasing its host range. It now does infect humans. It sounds like, especially in North Vietnam, that it's transmitting more efficiently in humans. It's affecting mammals like the tigers that I had mentioned, and it also is much more efficient at infecting laboratory mice,
as well as ferrets, which are what are used to make the anise syrup.
Mm-hmm.
So it has broadened its host range, so it is attacking more mammals. Obviously, it has this very high kill ratio, and those are the two ingredients that a pandemic virus makes. Mm-hmm. It's easily transmitted, and it kills a significant percentage of the people that it infects. And it's done all this without picking up, you know, any overt human gene. I mean, there were these subtle changes I mentioned, but right now the H5N1 that's doing the damage, as well as the H5N1 that's evolved in northern Vietnam, it still has 8 out of 8 avian genes. There are no whole human
mm-hmm.
genes in them.
Mm-hmm.
So now we mentioned the Marburg virus, and for those who aren't familiar, this is an outbreak that's been brewing in the West African nation of Angola since last October. It was officially recognized in March of this year. Marburg is a relative, you might say, of Ebola in that it is a hemorrhagic fever, which, that's really a gruesome way to go.
Sort of causes you to melt.
And the reports coming out of Angola, as Dr. Nyman mentioned, are not very encouraging. The World Health Organization isn't correcting some of these reporting errors, I understand, but it is showing a case fatality rate of, what would you say, Dr. Nyman, close to 90%?
No, it is actually close to 100%.
100%.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
That's one of the misconceptions that really came to the fore in the SARS outbreak, and that is if you want to calculate a case fatality rate, you really have to use known outcomes. So you have to look at how many people survived versus over how many people, how many people died over how many people died plus how many people survived mm-hmm. as in being discharged from the hospital. And that happened with SARS when it first broke. There were a lot of people that were diagnosed that were still in the hospital. And those numbers were going in the denominator, so they were creating an artificially low mm. case fatality rate.
Mm-hmm.
And then as those people started to die, then the rate started to go up. But if you just looked at outcomes and you didn't count the people that were in the hospital that you didn't know if they were going to live or die, but you looked at just the people that you knew were going to live because they were discharged and the people that had died and used that population, then you got a pretty steady rate. And if you apply that to Marburg, you get pretty close to 100%. I mean, there are no survivors.
There was a story in the news last weekend that health workers in Angola were being attacked by people in Angola, you know,
mm-hmm.
from rocks being thrown. And no wonder. I mean, if you're a villager there and you've seen that everyone who goes off with these people in the protective suits doesn't come back,
mm-hmm.
why would you want them coming to your house?
Yes.
Why would you even tell them that you were sick?
Right. And that has created a problem. And you know, that's a problem just as you described, is that, you know, initially they think, you know, you go in the hospital, you're going to get better. And then after a while, when they see that nobody has come out alive, and in fact, to try to limit the spread, they were actually burying the dead without having the family involved. So that essentially, you know, they were taken away and they literally never saw them again.
Which is a big deal in Africa.
It is. They need to wash
worship.
The body.
Yeah.
Right. So there was a fair amount, you know, of local resistance to that. And then, you know, there was some valid concerns over and above that, because it's a war-torn country, and there's, you know, especially where it started in this township of Ouige, which has about a population of 500,000, but it really was battered during the war, and they basically don't have electricity or running water in most of the buildings, and there are problems in the hospital that way.
Yeah.
So it's a less than ideal environment, and then they didn't really have adequate supplies of gloves and masks initially. I mean, now they have these Ebola suits, which, you know, they look like they're off a spaceship. But prior to that, they didn't have that. And it actually became a breeding ground for transmission. And
mm-hmm.
so you had healthcare workers that were dying, and you had patients that came in that didn't have the disease. They came in for something else,
mm-hmm.
and they went home, and a week later, all of a sudden, they had Marburg. So
mm-hmm.
it was transmitting within the hospital, and it was affecting the healthcare workers, and it was really a place to avoid. And that's one of the problems with controlling Marburg, that Marburg and Ebola in the past were basically controlled by contact tracing. So if somebody dies, you basically identify everybody that was in contact with that person while they were infectious. And you quarantine those people, and they're actually using a 21-day hospital quarantine where they're not only for SARS, they're basically having people do home quarantines there. They're literally putting people in the hospital for 3 weeks to make sure that that they're not infected.
Mm-hmm.
And the problem is that everybody's left, so that in this town of Weeds, it kind of irradiated out. They actually closed the hospital for a while. And so people didn't have anywhere to go, or there were too many people dying, and they didn't want to go there. And so people were dying in their neighborhoods. And people were actually leaving the city, but leaving the city infected and then
mm-hmm.
spreading it to adjacent provinces.
Mm-hmm.
So without the contact tracing, it's difficult because there are, you know, burial procedures with washing the body and coming in contact with the body, kissing the body goodbye
mm-hmm.
right before it's buried. And all these basically transmit the virus, you know, during the burial procedures. And of course, the people aren't trained as far as caring for their sick relatives, and so there can be transmission that way. And there is no real treatment, and there is no real cure. So you're not really the hospital's really not doing anything for
mm-hmm.
the patients. I mean, there was a case that was just written up in the New York Times, the first case in Luanda. In their isolation ward, and they didn't even want to start an IV on them because it was just too dangerous to have needles near
right.
near Marburg patients because of an accidental needle stick of the hospital worker or just you know, having more blood coming from the patient which is going to be full of the virus.
And yeah. Doesn't it take 5 to 10 days to incubate?
Yes, it's got a. I mean, that's a. It's a plus and a minus. It's a longer incubation period so that you have more time to actually quarantine people. It's a minus in that if people are leaving, they can be further away before they develop symptoms. And the initial symptoms are not that different than a lot of other diseases in Africa. The hemorrhaging is generally not until usually about a week after their symptoms. And,
mm-hmm.
and so they can have diarrhea, they can have things that look like typhoid, they can have other diseases that that might not be as contagious and certainly don't look like Marburg.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result, they can be transmitting at these earlier stages and people can get infected before they realize that they have hemorrhagic fever.
This is insidious. I mean, this is nasty. I mean,
yeah,
it's a disease
really
that's killing
nasty.
100%, roughly 100% of its the infected, and it masquerades as other diseases so that you don't even know that you've got it for a week to 10 days. This is really ugly. Now, what is the case fatality rate? I'm just curious, what's the case fatality rate for Marburg and Ebola been historically compared to this?
Well, they move around a little bit, and that was one of the reasons that this one looked, you know, very unusual. Marburg was originally isolated in Marburg,
mm-hmm.
not surprisingly, in Germany.
Germany, yeah.
And the way it got from Africa to Germany was it was a research lab, and they were using African green monkeys from Uganda that were infected. And, in fact, the first outbreak was in 1967, and it involved lab workers at two labs in Germany and two labs in Yugoslavia. There were 31 that were infected, and 7 of them died. So it was you know, in the neighborhood of 25% or so as far as the case fatality rate. Then there were a few outbreaks in Eastern Africa in the same area. There were some that was in the Democratic Republic of Congo, but it was in the northeast corner and it was really right next to Uganda and it was right next to Kenya where there had been outbreaks. And most of those outbreaks were also smaller in the neighborhood of 25%. The largest one was the one I'd mentioned in the northeast corner of the Democratic Republic of Congo. And there it got up to about 80%. So the worst Marburg outbreak, it was in this ballpark, but it wasn't at 100%. normally Ebola has a tendency to be at the higher level, and Ebola usually is closer to at least 50%. And the largest outbreak was not that far from where this current one is in Angola. It was also the Democratic Republic of Congo, but it was in the western portion, the southwestern portion, which was not that far from the Angola border. And that was in 1976, and that has a record. That had 280 people died, and the fatality rate there was about 88%. So that's kind of the one that people talk about, oh, there's a 90% fatality rate. With Ebola, that biggest one was did come close to that. The others are generally 50 to 80. There really hasn't been one that's been at 100%. And it's, you know, initially it was a little bit unclear if it was 100% just because of the conditions in the country. But the fact that it's maintained it now, and the official toll is like 235 or so.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I guess those are cases. I think it's 210 that have died. There, I mean, if you read the newspaper reports, nobody's saying, oh, well, this person, you know, was discharged and survived, his first one to survive, you know, in X amount of time. You don't read about those people because they don't exist. So, mm-hmm. So it's still running at 100%, and the difference between the number diagnosed and the number who died is just, that essentially is telling you the number of people that just came in the hospital.
The number of people whose clocks are ticking.
Right. These are the earlier stages. They've just been, you know, put into the reported positive category. And in many of these cases, they still have not laboratory confirmed them. In Ouija, I think there's 170 deaths. I think only 30 of them are laboratory confirmed. But it's pretty clear that, you know, why they died. They are dying at this 100% with all the symptoms. They just don't have the testing set up. And that was one of the other problems. I don't know if you read a couple of weeks ago, these mobile labs that came in to actually do testing in the field and you know, set up a testing facility. And they didn't have electricity. So
yeah.
They had the units there, but they couldn't really mm-hmm. run the testing. And that's one of the challenges. So initially, WHO sounded fairly optimistic. It was kind of like it took them a while to identify the agent. The agent wasn't identified until towards the end of last month. But it was kind of, well, we've dealt with Marburg in the past, and we'll come in and just do our contact tracing, and we'll get this under control in a few weeks. And, you know, it's unfortunate we came in late, but there's not a problem. One of the biggest problems is this in an urban setting, that in the past the cases have been more rural. It's been easier to control who the contacts are.
Mm-hmm.
And now a lot of Angola is just one big slum. And so it's people are living in close proximity. It's high density. It's under very poor conditions. They don't have electricity or running water. And so, you know, there's just sanitation issues. You know, mm-hmm. the vomit and diarrhea are two ways that the virus transmits.
Mm-hmm.
And you just have, you know, it's just hard to kind of keep the area clean. And so you just have, you know, virus all over the place, essentially.
Well, there's also an airport nearby, isn't there?
Yeah, there's actually an airport in both. There's an airport in Ouija, but that one I don't think is an international airport. But there is an international airport in Luanda. And,
right.
Luanda, you know, has a lot of foreign nationals who basically are involved with the oil industry. You know, there's some big corporations that are set up there.
Right.
And right now, I mean, I'm getting a lot of reports from people on the ground in Luanda, and it's like everybody has an evacuation plan, but nobody's really implemented it. One of the biggest concerns, though, is that it would get into the slums of Luanda and just kind of go through like wildfire. And there have been a few media reports that that have talked about a few patients that that were on the outskirts of Luanda in some of the poorer neighborhoods that didn't have any obvious ties to Ouija, and so it suggested that it was starting to transmit within Luanda. But one of the problems is that
the reporting isn't there. I mean, people don't want to tell the authorities that they have somebody sick because they're going to take them away to the isolation wards that nobody returns from.
Oh, yeah.
And so they're trying to treat people at home. They're burying them at home, you know, and privately. And so knowing exactly where the virus is has been a challenge. And so lately, the projections from WHO have not been that rosy. It's, well, this is going to take months to get under control, and we don't know the extent of the disease, and we don't know whether it's peaked yet. And in fact, the more recent statements have simply been that it hasn't peaked yet, and that it's going to get worse before it gets better. The problem is that there's not really a good historical backdrop, because you haven't had the virus essentially spreading in a urban setting, and so it's pretty much an unknown. But the concern is, I mean, for your listeners who are here in the United States or you know, Europe, anywhere but Africa, the big concern is that if it does start to spread through the slums of Luanda, that you know, a lot of people that are there are going to pack up and leave.
Yeah.
And it is already starting to affect employees. I've already got a couple reports from oil companies where, you know, one person was a security guard and all of a sudden he died, and another person, you know, went into weeds because a family member died. And so people are starting to get some firsthand knowledge where there's somebody they know or somebody related to somebody they know has been affected.
Mm-hmm.
And if it does start to move into the area, I mean, it won't take that much, because you have this initial period. I mean, even if everybody's honest and saying, oh, I don't feel well, I'm not going to leave the country. In fact, there's a chance it would be just the opposite, that
sure,
if they didn't feel well, they would want to get out of the country.
Absolutely.
And that's why a lot of the initial cases in Luanda actually were physicians that had been in weeds, because
sure,
they knew they weren't going to get treated there. They thought they had a chance in Luanda. It really hasn't come to pass so far. Everybody still has died. But there was that type of a movement. And then with an airport, you're going to have another wave of people that are just you know, hopping on planes. There's a lot of traffic between Angola and South Africa. So you could have it, you know, hop to another main municipality like Johannesburg or something, and then from there they could go to a lot of places in Europe and around the world.
Right.
And,
well, what do you think? Do you think that it's going to burn itself out, or do you think that the odds are that it's going to hop to another country?
I think the odds are it's going to hop, but it might not spread in another country. That as soon as it hops, it will be on the front page, and you know, there will be people will be on high alert. And if you can trace it, then it is controllable. So I think there's a good chance that it will get out of Angola and it will get out of Africa, but I don't know, you know, how likely it is to spread once it's done that. It kind of depends on how aggressive the tracing is. And that's the other aspect of this, is that it really didn't get that much attention. It got some attention at the beginning. And there were four samples that were sent to the CDC for testing. And they all came up negative. And it's not really clear why, but whenever you're starting an epidemic, you've got new people collecting samples. You have less than ideal circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
And then you've got to get it all packed up and shipped overseas. And so if you're missing some of these ingredients, you can have a sample that has virus, but by the time it gets to Atlanta, it's basically no longer viable, and
right,
it doesn't register in the test. And so initially they were negative, and it wasn't until, I mean, frankly, it really wasn't until the healthcare workers started to get infected. I mean, the initial cases were children under five, but doctors without borders indicated that the majority of the cases were actually under one.
Oh, wait a minute there. Now, is that normal for a disease of this type to start in children that young?
No, it's very unnormal and or abnormal. The normal, there isn't much of an age distribution. And that raises the issue that it somehow was transmitted in the hospital. And, you know, one possibility was that it was with childhood immunizations and possibly even dirty needles. So, I mean, the initial case could have come from who knows where, but then there was some transmission that happened just because the techniques weren't that sterile or needles were being used. And so children would come in and it would be in one particular location and you would continue to have children infected. Those numbers aren't very clear. I mean, the official numbers for the first 3 months of the outbreak, which was just October, November, December, I think they list like 14 patients. But media reports said that there were like 95 children that died in those first 3 months. And so a lot
wow.
of people that died. I mean, there's a high infant mortality rate there. So it's not like 95 was necessarily something that everybody was going to take note of, because there are a fair number of children that are dying.
Sure.
But it was, I mean, meetings were called, and I said, something isn't right here. You know, there's too many children that are dying. And I don't know how they got those numbers, because I'm not sure how well samples were collected
uh-huh.
and stored, because most of the testing, although those first four, really wasn't done until the middle of March or so. And so somehow that was extrapolated back. I mean, the original, the first set of numbers, I think, were 102 cases and 95 deaths. So that was the first report, and that went all the way back to the beginning. But it's not clear that's a very accurate number. In fact, it's not clear, you know, how many of these are accurate, because there's other hemorrhagic diseases there. I mean, there's dengue fever,
mm-hmm.
which
mm-hmm.
is transmitted by a mosquito, and most of the cases don't have a hemorrhagic fever associated, but some do. And so you could have hemorrhagic, you could have some of the same symptoms and really have dengue fever and not have Marburg. You know, it doesn't have this type of fatality rate, but it could mask some of the numbers. So some of the patients that had Marburg may have been just put into a category of hemorrhagic fever from dengue.
Hard to tell exactly what's been happening, and because of the way people are trying to hide the fact that they've got
mm-hmm.
Sick relatives, it's hard to tell what exactly is going on. And what's been really surprising to the two of us is that it hasn't seemed to have gotten a lot of attention from the mainstream media, at least
mm-hmm.
not as far as cable news on television is concerned. Now, we are seeing reports in newspapers, especially from overseas press services like the French, Reuters, BBC.
Mm-hmm.
But it really is surprising when you've got a disease with a case fatality rate of 100% that is apparently spreading, and the number of infections seems to be increasing fairly steadily, and is now, at least by a couple of maybe shaky reports, reaching the capital city, which is densely populated and close to an international airport. You just would think that somebody at one of the major news networks would say, hey, there's a story here. That's just really surprising.
Like I say, it usually takes, you know, a case if you have one person that gets transmitted by air, then
mm-hmm.
you know, the whole concept that all of these diseases are just one flight away kind of comes home. And there really hasn't been that type of a situation since SARS. And SARS, most of the international spread was at the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, a lot of people think that it was an overreaction, but I don't. I think it came very close. It fortunately had a longer incubation period, and the contact tracing worked fairly well, and basically the season ended. So it did end up stopping, and it didn't spread as badly as it started out, where there were a lot of healthcare workers that were dying. But
mm-hmm.
most of the international cases on SARS really came from one physician at the Metropole Hotel. So it was pretty easy to have 10 physicians at 10 hotels and have 10 times what was there, and then some of those not get contained. Mm-hmm. But by the same token, there hasn't really been an instance lately of an exotic disease that came and actually started killing people. I mean, and I don't think that when you get to 100% and it stays at 100%, that it's necessarily going to go down that much with better health care. Mm-hmm. So if you had that disease in Europe or in the United States, it would get quite a bit of attention.
Yeah.
And as far as Luanda is concerned, the controversy, it isn't that controversial. I mean, the cases in Luanda are acknowledged. The official report that came out on Monday, I think, has 12 cases in Luanda, 6 of which have died. So there's 6 people that are, you know, characterized as having Marburg that are still alive. And I've got reports on the ground that there's actually more than that. But the issue that started, there was a little more controversial is whether it was transmitting in Luanda, because most of the initial cases were physicians or people that were in weeds, and they, you know, weren't confident they were going to get much care, and so they went into Luanda to try to get better care. So the initial
sure.
cases in Luanda were not transmitted. They were transported, so they came in from weeds. But then there were a few cases that were showing up in these outlying slums that didn't have a tie-in. And there's a report on NPR. One of the Doctors Without Borders was interviewed, and she said that it was transmitting, that some of these cases, particularly in the suburbs, were had no ties to weeds. They didn't have any physical ties, so they've been in Luanda, and they didn't have any known people that were infected. You know, obviously, they probably had somebody they didn't know about.
Yeah.
So then those initial cases were over a week ago. So they were really a couple of weeks ago now. They were at the end of March. And so there's been time for some transmission
sure.
to happen. And it just isn't clear that it's racing through the suburbs, if you will. It's not clear that it's... There's hundreds of people. In fact, there probably are not hundreds of people. But it's not clear how many people are infected, though.
Well, I guess
you could have 100 people infected where they haven't really shown much symptoms yet. In a week or two, all of a sudden, the situation could change.
Exactly. Well, unfortunately, Dr. Nyman, we are running out of time for tonight. But you know what? We'd love to have you back in the future to discuss this further. And I hope we won't be having you back because it's here on U.S. soil that we have to discuss Marburg or the avian flu. But you never know.
Okay, well, I'd be happy to come back, and it is, both situations are pretty fluid. So
we'll definitely keep monitoring your website as you monitor the sources that you have, both in the media and on the ground. And for those of you listening who would like to see Dr. Nyman's commentary on what's in the news and his assessment and interpretation of what's being reported, you can visit his website for his company, Recombinomics. The website is www.recombinomics.com. That's RECOMBINOMICS.com. And we'll put a link to that in the show notes when we post this on the Internet. So yeah, you can link and get some real good assessment from an expert in molecular virology as to what's really happening. Dr. Nyman, thank you very much for your time. We sure appreciate it. And we'll talk with you again soon.
Thank you very much, Dr. Nyman. It's been an education.
Okay, Sharon and Derek, it was good talking to both
okay.
of you. Thank you.
That was some really in-depth information from somebody who knows what he's talking about, Dr. Henry Nyman of Recombinomics in Pittsburgh. And again, we'll post a link to his website so that you can look him up and see his take on what's being reported out there as regards the Marburg virus, the avian flu, H5N1 in Southeast Asia, and a number of other emerging diseases that are breaking out across the globe.
That was an amazing. I'm sitting here stunned. I just have stunned on my face, don't I?
Yes. It can be frightening when you think about a disease that that leads to death in such a horrifying way as Marburg. Ebola is better known, but they both kill in the same way. Essentially, well, you described it very well. So your blood vessels weaken to the point that they just begin to leak.
They leak, they ooze. I've heard it described literally as your body just melting down because your internal organs literally start to just collapse and melt.
Liquefy,
exactly.
Yeah. It's a terrible way to go. WorldNet Daily this past week did a story on Marburg, but they did it from the standpoint of speculating what might happen if a terrorist were to deliberately infect himself and then fly to a country for the express purpose of spreading the disease. Now, in speaking with Dr. Nyman, I don't believe that it spreads efficiently enough for that to be a realistic weapon. And maybe it's just me, but I think that trying to convince somebody to go through that process would be a little much, even for somebody who might otherwise strap on a bomb belt.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's a really terrible way to go. So meanwhile, we just ask you to pray for the people in Angola and especially the health workers that are over there right now, the people who have volunteered their time with Doctors Without Borders, who are going into these villages. And Wiege, even though it has 500,000 people, has been described in some of the stories I've read as just a giant village because it has no running water, mm-hmm. no electricity. And these doctors are going in and volunteering to put themselves in the path of a disease that kills everyone it infects. It doesn't take much in the way of contact with bodily fluid from an infected person to contract the disease. But again, our purpose is not to frighten, but to inform. These things will come, and now you know our take on what's coming as we approach the end of days. These things have been written and have been available to people for 2,000 years.
Mm-hmm.
The Apostle John on the island of Patmos wrote down a number of things, and what we may be seeing here are just warm-up exercises for the pale horse.
That's right. That's right. With everything that we've been talking about this episode and the previous one, parts one and two, last week, Myth Arc number six, we instituted a movie recommendation for the week. And this week I'm going to recommend Outbreak.
Yes, Dustin Hoffman.
Dustin Hoffman movie. It deals with hemorrhagic fever, and it takes, I would have to say, a bit of a conspiracy leaning, but it's really informative. It can, if you're not really sure how it would affect people over here, I think the movie does a good job of showing what could be a really frightening scenario.
Okay, so that's our movie recommendation for the week. Your homework, as we continue, you know, with Myth Arc 101, Dustin Hoffman's film Outbreak.
In the meanwhile, go to Recombinomics.com and check out Dr. Henry Nyman's many words of wisdom on there. He keeps up to date on the news, too.
Yes, and he's got
some... You'll find all kinds of links.
Right, and he's developing sources on the ground as people recognize that he's an expert in this field, and they're passing information to him that is going around.
Yeah, we were really blessed to get him on the show because he is in demand.
Yeah,
he's very much in demand.
And we do appreciate the fact that he took so much time out of his night, well past normal hours for interviews, I would think.
That's right. I hear that music again. Here comes Steve Grace. Hey, listen, it was great. We may be doing a regular Sunday night show just to see what's going on for the week. So in the meanwhile, enjoy this extra treat of the double feature.
And we'll hear you next time, or you'll hear us next time, or we'll... See you next
Happy
time.
Happy trails.
Thanks for listening to Myth Arc
Sorry,
Radio.
Sorry, Steve.
A better day is coming soon to get us out of here. Don't let the hard times get you down. Older days will disappear. A new day.
edge news and analysis on demand.
This is PID Radio.